Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casello, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy April? I don't know. What do we have this week?
Happy Mets Day.
Yes.
A tradition unlike any other. Dan and I get super high on the Mets, and then they just stab us in the face somewhere around July.
Or May.
Or in rare instances, October.
Sometimes October, sometimes even April, but it's so far no. So far we are cruising at a solid altitude at 5-1 to start the year.
I would very much agree. It is weird. I don't know how to feel about it. I'll just say that I am cautiously optimistic, and wake me up sometime around late May. Let's see where we're at.
Yeah, usually like the second or third week in May is where things start to fall apart if they are going to fall apart, which is most years. So we are well aware of how this usually goes, but I'm happy with the fast start.
And that is your weekly spring/fall Mets update to start the podcast.
Hopefully/fall. Spring for sure.
Yeah, spring for sure.
As anyone who's followed this team or followed our podcast while we follow this team knows.
Anyway, Dan, plenty of things have happened in the Syracuse neck of the woods in the last week. One of them in particular was a bit of a crushing blow to like next year's kind of top 10 aspirations. Darius Bazley, no longer with the program. He will be going to the G League instead of coming in as a freshman. That's highly unfortunate. I wish him the best personally, but obviously not doesn't really do us any favors, and it's a bummer to lose that kind of caliber of talent, even if he was only going to be a one and done.
Yeah, it's tough, and we've had like similar things. I mean, it's not like a huge difference than losing Chris McCullough after, you know, what, a dozen games, and then right. Having him go. So it stinks, and it was very jarring, and obviously there were many feelings shared online. Hopefully, you know, I think it's fair to be upset for the team, but also like hopefully people can do their best to stay relatively classy in terms of like what it means for him personally, because, you know, you can disagree with the decision or you can say, you know, this isn't maybe, I mean, it doesn't really matter what any of us think, but I think it's fair to say, like, I don't know how this is going to go, but at the same time, it's not like it's none of our lives that are being directly impacted by this. So hopefully it works out for him. I mean, he's trying to break new ground. Obviously there have been guys who have skipped college and gone abroad and whatnot, but he feels that the G League is the best thing for him. So, I mean, I think we should all try to do our best to respect that. And hopefully he ends up being, you know, a lottery pick next year and does well in the G League. And it prepares him the way he hopes it does. So we'll see how it goes. It stinks for Syracuse, but it doesn't really seem like Syracuse itself had much to do with this. Like,
right.
If he had stayed committed to Ohio State, it kind of seems like his mind was on this for a little while either way. And then something after the McDonald's game just, like, led him to pull the trigger. So we'll see what happens. I mean, it definitely lowers our ceiling for next year, but there's only so much you can do. It doesn't really sound like there's anything that Syracuse could have really done to change his mind here.
Totally. And, like, I didn't really buy Syracuse having that low of a floor next year. So I think even without him, I still like our chances. I still think we're a top 25 team without him. You know, I got into this in the comments with folks and on Twitter with people where, like, maybe this is just speaking from like a writing standpoint and trying to, like, obviously I write about the team in a biased way, but over time I've been able to at least take a couple steps back. That doesn't always apply during football games if there's just repetitive bubble screens or if the defense isn't doing anything. But I do try in the articles at least to take that step back or two. And for me, I think the big key here was what you alluded to, separating how you feel about this decision and its effect on Syracuse versus the decision that Bazley made for himself and his family. And those two things are completely apart from one another. I think that, you know, I find it hard to believe that you can complain about the one and done era and what it's done to college basketball and then also get mad about this. Because to me, this is the potential for his domino to fixing the one and done era, whether that's, you know, a 2-and-none situation or a 0-and-3 situation as we see in baseball, or just getting rid of 1-and-dones altogether, having the G League be much more of a feeder system. Like, these are all things that are going to be addressed in part or in whole as a result of this one decision. Obviously, some of the machinations were going there. Adam Silver's talked about getting rid of one and done for a while. But in general, like this, something like this was bound to happen. It just the poor luck of the draw in Syracuse's case that it was, you know, our top 10 recruit that didn't end up coming to campus because of it.
Yeah, versus Duke, who has, you know, four of them, and, you know, they couldn't lose one. They couldn't spare one.
How about you just lose all of them?
Yeah, or all of them. That'd be fine. Like, I think we all would have been really tickled and been praising Zion Williamson if it was him, but it was Baisley, so we were all very upset, which I get. I get how fandom works, but it is a little hypocritical because I do think that a lot of the fans who were disparaging it, at least at first before cooler heads prevailed, would have been a lot more optimistic about this in terms of as like a progressive idea and venture for, you know, literally any other program's player. So I think we all just have to, like, pretend like it's a football decommit who, like, left on signing day. Like, eventually, you know, a month later, you kind of forget he was even part of the class. And unless he, you know, best case, like, he becomes, like, a, you know, a star player. And you're like, oh, what could have been? But, like, at the end of the day, he was never at Syracuse. So it's hard to really count this as, like, a huge, you know, loss to the program when he never really joined it in the first place. So it stinks. But I think by fall, unless he's, like, tearing down the G League somewhere, I think we'll mostly, like, kind of not forget about it. It'll always be a footnote, but it'll end up being like that at most.
Yeah, I mean, from a content standpoint, as others have mentioned, I kind of hope he ends up in Greensboro.
Oh God,
just for the fun of it. But there's obviously
for the lulz.
There's obviously a lot of other random outposts he could end up at. I wouldn't mind, to be honest, if he ended up for the South Bay Lakers. If only because then I could actually catch a game, go see things. I realized the other day, I don't know why I hadn't known this before, that that James Sutherland's actually playing for the South Bay Lakers right now.
I did not know that. Yeah. I didn't realize he was still trying out in the G League.
Neither did I. So I honestly would have, like, caught a game. That would have been entertaining, would have been fun to see, you know, Sutherland in action. Obviously, I wouldn't say he's as polarizing as a lot of other Syracuse players in recent memory, but at the same time, he could definitely run hot and cold, and I choose to appreciate all the times he was running hot, and I think a lot of others would as well. Obviously, his time with you know, Boeheim's Army has helped that a little bit too. So yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing him. If the G League playoffs continue and the South Bay Lakers end up hosting some more games, maybe I pop over there, since their stadium's only about like 15 minutes from my house.
Yeah, I assume 15 minutes over there is like 1 mile?
Probably like 2.5. In rush hour, it's probably half an hour.
This has been LA jokes that we can all appreciate, even though if we haven't been there in 15 years.
This is true. So, Dan, do you think that Darius Baisley's departure has any effect on Tyus Battle's decision, or do you think that those things are completely separate of one another?
I assume they're separate. It was interesting in that I think literally the day before, Baisley was like talking directly about the possibility of playing with Battle and how much he would like to do it, but how he wasn't going to like, you know, worry too much if he decided to make the decision to leave for the NBA. And then obviously Baisley made the decision he made out of nowhere. So I don't think it has much of an impact either way. I think that Baisley did what he's going to do, and I think Battle's going to do what he's going to do regardless of that. I don't think there was really any indication. I don't know if anyone's asked Battle about it. I don't think I've seen anything like that, but it didn't seem like there was any indication.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm Battle, I think, if anything, this kind of gives you the idea to bet on yourself a little bit more. And you know, kind of take your future in your own hands. Like, obviously, everyone has different economic situations and different aspirations for their college degree and their career and playing basketball and all that, but if I'm him, I feel like, you know, a 17-year-old kid making that decision for himself, probably, if I thought about it even for a second, and if some agents started telling me or some scouts started telling me that I could be, you know, a late first or a mid-second round pick, I think that seals the deal for me, and I'm probably making the jump.
Yeah, I still fully expect Battle to do it, and you know, hopefully the best thing we can ask for as Syracuse fans who are invested in the team doing well is trying to see if he can go do the combine without signing an agent. Obviously, I feel like most of our guys have just signed agents outright since that rule changed. But I think hopefully that's the direction he goes. He gets the accurate feedback from the franchises that he wants to hear, and then he makes an informed decision. I think that's pretty no no lose. I mean, the only real argument is that Syracuse doesn't know if it has to hold that scholarship open or not. But at this point, I'm sure Boeheim's reaching out to players, you know, possible grad transfers or other transfers regardless, and just getting their I know we haven't really been connected to many that I can think of, but I'm sure we're preparing for both situations. I don't think we're going to get caught blindsided either way here.
Yeah, I feel like Boeheim's kind of used to this at this point. And the program's kind of used to running this way at this point, where there's going to be some question marks about the draft. There's going to be a scholarship or two that's kind of up in the air. I feel like they knew about Moyer for a bit. So I think they were probably already like making preparations there. Obviously, they thought Baisley was going to be, kind of fitting into that position. But nonetheless, yeah, I feel like Battle probably holds off on hiring an agent. I know that kind of leads into O'Shea Brissett, who indications after the Duke game and today, well, I guess was it today on TSN Radio in Vancouver, that it seems like he's definitely, it seems like he's not definitely staying, but it seems like he's very heavily leaning towards staying and said he wants to be back at school. But I feel like there's a lot more packed into that quote, Dan. I don't know how much like you decided to like dig into it or really see that like, it's not that the wording was like very careful, it's just that the wording was equal parts committal and non-committal all at once.
Yeah, it sounded basically like maybe he'll go test the waters, but odds are either way he'll be back. And I wouldn't really blame him for testing the waters just to see, what is out there. But overall, I think it was generally a positive thing. He just didn't want to like commit to definitely 100% coming back. And then, if something happened, if he goes to the combine and gets really good results, like I don't think he wanted to like totally go back on his word. So he left himself that out. But overall, I do expect that he'll be back. And I expect him to be really, really good next year, which is, possibly going to need him to be the best player on the team, which, if he beats that freshman to sophomore jump, might not be the worst for Syracuse, as I think he could be, an all-conference type player.
Yeah, I mean, going into next year, if I'm just looking at the ACC, like at a tertiary glance, I think he's probably an all-ACC player. I think he's, even if Battle comes back, I might put Brissett as the best player on the team. That's not to knock Battle. It's just to look at, Brissett's versatility and what he's been able to do even as a freshman scoring and what he'd probably be able to round into as a sophomore. Like, I definitely see him as someone who, it's not that he couldn't shoot up draft boards this year, but I think that scouts are waiting for him to show he puts all that together, or at least puts a few more thoughts in people's heads of what he can do. I think you started seeing a little bit of it this year. There were games where he really looked completely dominant. There were other games where he kind of went silent. Maybe that's just because of the lack of real offensive system this year, the defensive focus, the fact that it was 3-on-5 most times when SU had the ball. But I do want to see next year, and I think scouts want to see next year, him be a much more confident ball handler, really finishing at the rim. Those are the sort, like if he can add, 15 pounds of muscle in the offseason, those are all things that, like, if Brissett does all that, then he's a top 10 pick next year, no problem.
Yeah, I think it's finishing at the rim, efficiency. Obviously, if he becomes, like, a lights-out three-point shooter, then we have, like, a really, like, next-level player. But overall, I think, an improvement in terms of his consistency shooting the ball, a big improvement at the rim, and then he continues to rebound the way he has and states even a step up in his defense, like, he's a really special player, even if he makes like modest improvements across the board there, because he was already really, really good as a freshman, despite having some obvious flaws. So I'm really excited to see what he turns into. I expect him back, and that could be huge for SU. I think he's going to be a special one.
Oh, yeah, bringing back a guy that had 15-9 in his freshman season, and he could be better than that. Like you said, even if he had marginal improvement next year, I would put him at around, 18-11? And, I think you put up that sort of production for a team that could finish, around the top 5 or 6 in the ACC. Like, yeah, that's a player that's definitely in the all-ACC conversation, maybe in the Conference Player of the Year conversation, maybe even more than that if he's able to surpass those numbers.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable expectation. It's always tough because, we have teams like Duke that bring in these like mega stars every year, but there's something to be said for college experience, and there's no reason why he couldn't be like, an 18-9 guy wouldn't be a huge step up from what he did this year, which is crazy to think. Like, that's a couple extra baskets. And honestly, if he just improved his shooting near the rim, like, he could get there pretty, you know, without much of a drastic change.
So I guess, too, what's probably, and if we're assuming that Battle leaves, and I think we both are, Dan, what do you think, like, a cautious kind of outlook is right now? I know I put mine up and a bunch of other people put theirs up the other day on the site, but, like, what's your kind of cautious look at, like, what this team can do? Obviously, keeping in mind the tournament is a crapshoot and that matchups dictate more than just about anything at this point.
I think it was interesting to see Lenardi. Obviously, this is like the stupid, way too early bracketology, but interesting to see him have us as a five seed. I assume he's counting Battle in.
Yeah.
I think without Battle, I still think we should be like a solid tournament team, maybe like a six or a seven. Obviously, a lot is predicated on how Brissett improves and, you know, steps into that like number one player role if he is thrust into that. Obviously, we still have Frank Howard, who should, with another year of grooming, and really this is like his first year of a ton of playing time, which people seem to forget. It's not like he got like a ton last year. He had his moments, but it wasn't like he was like a crucial player for us. So I think year two of a starter, really like experienced Howard, year two of Brissett, if Dolezal, you know, I think we saw enough of like late season Dolezal without, you know, it wasn't just like a one-off thing. That we can be pretty excited about him. So overall, like, I'm pretty bullish on this team even without Battle. Not having Baisley is obviously a blow, and you need to figure out, you know, we need Elijah Hughes to step up and be a big contributor at the two. But I think there's still a lot to like here.
Oh, yeah. I think that's, like, outsiders might not have seen that incremental progress that we saw. I think even some people within the fan base, you know, I saw a lot of doubts about if Battle left, how he'd be able to put up more than 65 points a game. To be honest, I see it just by way of who's, you know, coming. Like, Frank should be able to put up 1 to 2 more points per game. Brissett should be able to put up 3 to 4 more points per game. Dolezal should actually be a contributor for the full season, and that gives him, let's say, another 3 to 4 points per game. Sidibe will be healthy. That's more points per game. Elijah Hughes is somebody who's probably going to score 10 to 12. Like, so that difference gets made up very quickly. And that's something that everyone should probably keep in mind. I don't think this team is going to suddenly turn into an offensive juggernaut, but I think there's going to be more options. And again, a lot of that does hinge on Sidibe, though. And if he can be, he doesn't have to be who he was against Pitt, you know, when he had 18 points. But if he could be someone that we can rely on for, you know, 10, let's say 8 points, let's say 8 points, 7 boards a game, you know, somebody in that like Tyler Robertson range, like, that would be a vast improvement and give us, you know, yet another player that we could actually utilize on the offensive end, which wasn't the case for much of this season.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we know that Sidibe has the ability to be an offensive threat because of the Pitt game, which was a little bit of an aberration, but when you know, remember that he was very injured all year and probably shouldn't have been playing if we didn't really need him. I'm definitely bullish on what he can bring, and that goes for a lot of the team. I mean, it's hard to, like, always remember because so many guys were playing so many minutes, but this was a very banged-up club, especially down the stretch when we were playing our best basketball. So just having fresh players and hopefully a deeper rotation and being able to play, like, 8 or 9 guys versus, like, 6.5, depending on how Sidibe was feeling on a given day, will pay huge dividends just in and of itself, and that's before players improving with an extra year in the system.
Oh, 100%. The depth stuff's great, and I know a lot of people have been discounting depth just because of how few players Boeheim's usually, you know, utilize. But, I mean, look at the roster right now. You just ran down pretty much everybody. That's only, like, 7 or 8 guys. And again, it's the useful depth and valuable depth. Having everybody healthy, all that's going to mean, you know, a big, big difference. And I am really looking forward to this team for the first time in, like, I wouldn't say I wasn't looking forward to these last few seasons, but I feel like I'm seeing that familiar feeling that we had from, like, 2000, I'd say probably 2000, like post-Jerry, for most of those seasons, say the last few, there's been this, like, kind of, well, yeah, if things break right, then this, and this can happen. I feel like 2 years ago, the team that missed the NCAA tournament, there was some uneasiness about how everyone was going to fit in. We thought, because Boeheim was talking really highly of these guys, and we knew Leiden was a known commodity, other players were known commodities, we felt like we really knew what we had in our hands. But I feel like we didn't have the same, like, kind of, this should be a tournament team, but, like, you know, a couple things to break here and there, and maybe we end up falling a couple more seeds than we think we should. Like, I feel like, again, like, this feels familiar to me. In a good way. And, you know, this is going to start looking familiar to a lot of Syracuse fans as we get back to, like, standard program building and not the kind of, you know, on-the-fly mercenary things that we've had to do in recent seasons.
Yeah, I think, like, basically, unless something completely out of... I mean, a second thing completely out of nowhere happens, like, we should be in that place where we don't have to worry too much about making the tournament. And I think it's funny because of two of these last three seasons... I think there's actually, like, improved confidence in Boeheim's ability to lead this team kind of no matter what happens. Obviously, there's always been this, like, weird, like, anti-Boeheim sentiment of the fan base, but I think they've been very quiet, and it's because of how impressive these two tournament runs with these lesser teams has been. So I think now, like, the next time we actually have, like, a fully stacked team, you know, whether it's next year or whenever, people are going to be even more excited for Syracuse basketball than they have been, like, you know, during the years where we, you know, knew we'd be pretty good.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that for a second. Hopefully we see some... I mean, we've had some large dome crowds in recent years, but hopefully it gets back to kind of those 2009 to, like, you know, 2014 levels of you know, nightly crowds over 22,000 or so. But Dan, why don't we talk a little beer? Since we're I think we're about at halftime.
Yeah, let me look. I've had, like, a couple things. I don't know that I've had anything... super... Actually, no, that's a lie. I had a couple things. Last week, I had... I'm trying to remember. When was the last time we recorded?
We recorded last week, but the episode never went up because most of it was super dated because of the Baisley situation.
Yeah. That's what I thought. I was pretty sure that hadn't gone up. So since then, which was last Wednesday, I'll just go back and, like, recap because then, you know, none of that was talked about. So I had a Five Boroughs Brewing Goza, which is one of the many, many Brooklyn breweries that have popped up in recent years. This was a couple weeks ago now, but this was, like, really delicious. Obviously, I'm a big Goza fan, which, you know, anytime I've had them, they come up here. But that one was really good. I had a Finback IPA, which is also always really solid, one of the better beers around here. I had an Edward from Hill Farmstead, one of their very many great IPAs. And there's usually this one bar that I go to a decent amount where they almost always have something from them, which is nice. I had a Secure the Bag from Barrier Brewing, which was probably the biggest, you know, surprise of the week for me. Not that I didn't think it was going to be good, but it was among the better beers from local beers, especially I've had in a long time. That was another IPA. And then a little more recently, I had a Leoverse Ursus Inferno by Firestone Walker, which is a rye, which was quite good. And then I think that's about it in terms of, like, super interesting things.
Nice. One of my best friends was in town last week, so I drank pretty heavily. Had a bottle of Noise and Flesh from Orpheus. It's a wild ale from them. Orpheus is down in Atlanta. And I got to grab a bottle from them when I was in Atlanta a few weeks ago. It was great to finally crack that one open. It's a wild ale, like I said, super good. If you're down in Atlanta, stop over there and grab some. Had a Booming Rollers from Modern Times. Had Lord Hobo from Massachusetts. Their Boom Sauce Double IPA was actually out here for some reason. I didn't know that their distro got this far, but I grabbed some of that at a Yard House before a Kings game last week. And what else? Went down to Beechwood in Long Beach. Went to the Blendery, their sour tasting room. Had a Funk Salad. I had Careful With That Apricot, Eugene. Just a really, really good lambic from them. Had a Into the Great Unknown. And I had one of their Propagation Series Saisons that was super good. Had to grab a Citraholic pint over at the actual... you know, like, restaurant tasting room. And then they had their new LBC IPA. It's a West Coast style IPA they have in cans, so I picked up a six pack on the way out and enjoyed that for the weekend. Had that, had a Stone Go-To IPA, And then my buddy brought some Ponto from Pizza Port, Session IPA, over while we were hanging out outside on Saturday. So, yeah, busy beer weekend.
Nice. I'll actually be in Atlanta early next month, so I'll look out for that. Which one was that again? The
Orpheus. Definitely.
Okay. I don't even have anything from them, and I go down there a decent amount.
Yeah. Go to Orpheus. It's over by the park. Really cool spot. Really nice people. Would definitely highly recommend that.
Nice. I'll check it out.
Yeah. So I guess the second half here. Damn, we got the spring game next Friday. We're going to talk a little bit more about it next week, but it's going to be offense versus defense. I feel like the offense is going to be not much to talk about once again, just because Dino Babers keeps everything pretty close to the vest. I feel like the defense is going to look pretty good. Last year they did as well. It was a 10-0 game was the final. And I'm kind of looking forward, to be honest, to seeing a whole bunch of Tommy DeVito out there, because given Dungy's limited status all spring, the fact Rex Culpepper, yes, he was throwing today, but obviously, you know, he's undergoing cancer treatment, and we wish him, you know, the best of luck fighting that fight. He's probably going to be limited, if not completely out, on the spring game. So it's really going to be a Tommy DeVito showcase, and I feel like that's something a lot of fans have actually been kind of looking for these past, you know, 18 months or so.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, we kind of know what Dungy is. I don't know that anyone, obviously it'd be cool to see him, but like, I don't think anyone really needs like Eric Dungy in the spring game. DeVito's like been the headliner for, you know, since he officially joined the program. We haven't seen him play in any kind of game action. So yeah, I think this is actually pretty exciting to get a game where he's probably going to play like half the snaps, because I mean, who's going to be the second quarterback? Probably
Chance Amy.
Yeah. So which is, also exciting because he was a pretty, you know, nice late addition to our recruiting class. But yeah, overall, like I think that there are worse situations than to get a big Tommy DeVito outing.
Yeah, I mean, big Tommy DeVito outing. I think Chance will give us maybe a look at some new dual threat sets that that the team might be installing for Dungy. Hopefully they're a little bit less reckless than the dual threat sets that were previously in there for Dungy. Although, who really knows how much of that was based on play calling and how much of that was based on Dungy's play calling. The constant question that I feel like is once again going to lord over the season. I'll be sad when Dungy's done. But the one thing I will be a little bit happier about is the lack of that lingering kind of cloud over the season of you know, Dungy getting hurt, Dungy making his own decisions out there all the time. And the kind of just like fly by the seat of your pants nature of the Syracuse offense. Like, I'm sure Babers will never address this, but I am curious, and I think we might start to see some hints of it with DeVito, who's probably been taking more first team reps than we could have imagined. Like to see him really, you know, operating in this spring game and seeing what this offense is supposed to look like and how he's able to gain an early rapport with a lot of these young receivers that are going to be getting their own first reps during this spring game as well.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. DeVito's a pretty different player from what we know than Dungy, and obviously he's one that Babers identified. He inherited Dungy, and obviously I'm sure he's glad he did because he got a very good quarterback, but DeVito is more of a guy that he hand-selected basically right off the bat when he took over as head coach. So it will be interesting to see how much different the offense looks just by the fact that they have a very different quarterback and one who is more suited and was hand-selected to run this offense versus Dungy, who is great and has very unique skills that make him a lot of fun to watch. But a lot of the good things about Dungy are just predicated on his like fearlessness and his ability to make plays outside of like the general machinations of the offense versus DeVito, who I think is going to be more of like, you know, making quick reads and making all the throws versus like breaking outside the pocket and, you know, busting a 30-yard run out of nowhere. So that should definitely be fun to see, especially in like a low pressure situation like the spring game, where we can kind of take a deeper dive at anything. Not that I think we're going to like see all of this offensive secrets at once, because that's not who Babers is, but it definitely has a little more juice than like the normal spring game.
Yeah, and we'll just be able to see what a lot of these unproven players can do. Between DeVito, a bunch of the receivers. I mean, losing Ishmael and Phillips, obviously just kind of paves the way for a bunch of these guys that, you know, we luckily got to redshirt, some of the ones we didn't, and Nakeem Johnson looked pretty good in the slot last year. I know he had some end-around plays. He just seemed like an interesting and versatile player, the type of guy that, like, will probably remind you of what the old offense was trying to do with Brizzly Esteem and maybe, like, Ben Lewis throwing it back a few more years. Like, just kind of a jack-of-all-trades and a guy who might, you know, see some carries, but someone who's going to be utilized in that slot role. We'll see how much Jamal Custis is actually used in the slot. I know that was a topic of conversation earlier this week, and that should be very interesting. Plus, like, I know you and I have talked about this since last year. Like, if Custis is using the slot to kind of find space between the linebackers and the defensive line, I'm very curious to see how that affects how we're going to use Ravian Pierce, who I felt like thrived in that role last year.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. Obviously, I think especially in the NFL level, like, you see a lot more of tight ends being used the way that we're describing Custis being used. And obviously, he's played, like, some kind of hybrid tight end wide receiver role at times here. His role changes all the time. But with a guy like Pierce, who is maybe the most veteran returning pass catcher we have, to be honest, it is interesting to see how those two, like, what the difference in those two roles are, because it seems like they're going to be doing very different things. But Pierce did fill some of what it sounds like Custis is doing. Maybe Custis will just be more about, like, stretching the field deep versus Pierce, who kind of down that those in between levels, but we've been calling for Custis to be used in a unique way for the entire time he's been on the roster. So
maybe this year,
we'll see. I'm all for it. Like, I totally trust Babers to make a move like that. It's not something that's, like, so jarring that it's just like, oh, they it wasn't working out at this position, so they're burying him somewhere else. Like, this is a very specific role they want him in, so I trust them to make the best of it.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, at this point, if they don't use Custis as, you know, kind of a post-up option in the red zone, that's fine. I don't really care anymore. I just think
we're totally over it.
Yeah, we're totally over it. I just want to find a way to use him. And I don't know if deep threat's the way to go either. He just doesn't necessarily have the speed to beat, quality corners. And really kind of, like, I think he can outjump most safeties. He's 6'5", but I don't know how much he's going to be able to beat most corners off the line, especially if they give him a little bit of room to operate. This is where, you know, some of the other kids can come in. Sherrod Johnson, Russell Thompson Bishop, Cam Jordan. Like, these are all kids that, you know, have a lot of speed, can function on the outside. Like, I am very intrigued by that. And I'm also really intrigued by, you know, somebody who became a little bit of a often criticized player, I'd say, last year, but somebody who I was given a little bit more of a pass, Devin Butler. He caught, like, 33 passes, which I know I, like, joked with people afterward, like, the quietest 33 passes anyone's ever caught in a college football season, but caught 33 passes last year, looked good in spurts, not so good in others. Sean Riley's another guy who, like, can't really forget about him. I know everyone kind of fell off the Sean Riley bandwagon after he dropped that sure touchdown pass against LSU last year. But, you know, he's another guy who should be able to factor into this offense, even as a lesser role, while I think he should thrive once again in the return role.
Yeah, to be honest, like, Riley's one of the guys, like Pierce, who has the most experience in this offense. Like, you can discount him because he had a lot of bad drops last year, but he's also had, like, a couple big games, and he made his impact on the offense more so than most of who we are bringing back. So I wouldn't count him out at all.
Yeah, I think, honestly, like, people also forget, like, there is a little bit of a jump that, like, some players, it's freshman to sophomore year. I feel like in football, it's more of a sophomore to junior year thing. That's where Butler is. That's where Riley is. Like, these are guys who should be able to make that transition. Doesn't mean that they're suddenly going to catch 95 passes, but, and you and I have talked about this before, too, like, if you pencil four different guys in for 50 catches, that's basically mimicking the production that we lose with Phillips and Ishmael heading out the door.
Yeah. I think that's probably the biggest mystery of this whole offense, to be honest, is just, I mean, and honestly, I don't know how concerned we should be, because we've kind of made it work with our receivers the last 2 years in ways that we probably didn't expect. Obviously, Ishmael was a little more predictable than what happened 2 years ago with
Hedetawa,
whose name was slipping my mind despite the fact that he had a million yards. Yeah, it's been a long week. But overall, I think if we can trust Babers to do anything, it's to get some production out of his receivers. So it's a little scary to not have an established eye, but, you know, 2 years ago, our established eye was Ishmael, and he had a relatively quiet year, and Edetawo came out of nowhere to be one of the best receivers in the country. So I think we can be relatively hopeful that that Babers will figure this one out.
Yeah, I said it too, like, you know, back when we were talking about this at the end of the season, like, having no, like, surefire number one option could be the best thing for Dungy as a passer, could be the best thing for this offense. You saw what happened last year when, you know, when teams started keying in on Phillips and Ishmael, there wasn't much else for this offense to do. The players weren't necessarily ready to step up in that role, talking about Butler, maybe Pierce to some extent, and Riley. Like, now you have them and all these kids. You could have, you know, 6-7 guys who could really, you know, get the ball at any moment. Like, that might benefit this offense much more. It might benefit Dungy. Like, there's a lot to like. We're going to start to see probably some of that ground, you know, some of that work laid down in this spring game between them, the running game. I'm also really curious, I know you probably are too, about the linebacker situation. I think we're better situated than people think with who we have in there, but I just want to see how... Not if they can play and if they can be starters. I know that the guys in there can be. I want to see how much better they fit the Tampa 2 scheme as it's intended versus last year and the year before is kind of altered Tampa 2 that was obviously, you know, compromised to fit the skill sets of guys like Zaire Franklin and Paris Bennett.
Yeah, that's also a good point. And obviously losing two linebackers of their caliber is tough, but...
Plus Jonathan Thomas. And Austin Valdez.
Yes. But these were all, like, just like we have with Dungy, like, these are all still inherited players. So, you know, if you trust coaching staff to step in and plug their guys in, like, these are the guys that they really wanted versus the guys who they just happened to have. Because I don't know, you know, I don't think Dino Babers took this job to coach Zaire Franklin. I think that's a luxury he had by, you know, having a 3-year captain on the roster. But overall, like, pretty cautiously optimistic about the defense. I think we took a big step forward last year, obviously. It's still not where we need it to be, but I trust the staff, and I think they've done a pretty nice job in terms of, you know, I think you can kind of see you can see where they're going. It might take another year or two, but I don't think this is ever, with the way this offense plays, I don't know if the defense is ever going to be this, like, lockdown thing, but we've seen with other teams, you just need to be opportunistic and not allow teams to just totally dictate the pace of the game and let the offense do its job. So we'll see. It's tough to get, like, people super tight about the defense because it's never going to be the, like, main thing in a Dino Babers team. But I do think last year was a nice step forward, and I wouldn't be shocked if we take another one even with you know, all the losses we have, especially at the linebacker position.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, like, if you separate, and like I've talked about this when I was previewing each position group, if you look at like the first 7 games versus the last 5, like those first 7 games, everybody was pretty much healthy. We still had, I mean, I would say everybody in the back 7 was pretty much healthy. We lost a bunch of players in defensive line, and all those guys are back. The linebackers probably take a slight step back, but at the same time, they also might be a better fit for the scheme. So who knows? Maybe it's a, you know, I mean, it's weird to say that, you know, replacing somebody like Franklin or Bennett is suddenly like this, you know, zero-sum game. But at the same time, like, if they fit the scheme better, it might end up working out for us. I'm very curious to see how Ryan Guthrie, a guy who was kind of brought in from the JUCO ranks as, like, a tackle for loss specialist, how he functions as a middle linebacker. Because that, to me, and I mentioned this in the linebacker preview, like, I always saw Andrew Armstrong as the guy that would kind of, you know, come in after Franklin to serve that role. So it's seeing Guthrie as, you know, in the middle linebacker really is kind of the fulcrum of this entire defense. He's somebody who has to be able to play the run and the pass, be able to drop back in coverage. I'm really curious to see how Guthrie plays, and I think we're going to see a bunch of that in the spring game. But in general, like, I think if we can take what we did in the early parts, if we have our full complement of safeties, we have our cornerback depth that we can actually utilize, like, I'm not saying that this should be a top 50 defense. I think that if this is a top 80 defense at the end of the season, I'll be happier by raw numbers. But what I want to see, and it's kind of what you were alluding to, I know, is give me the tempo-free stats, those efficiency numbers. I want to see those, you know, Bill C's figures. We can get a better descriptor of how this team is looking, you know, on a per play and per down basis. And then, like, you know, some of the places where we've really struggled of late, yards per attempt have been poor at best. Big plays, if we can limit those, I think that helps a ton there. I think it, even if we just look at those two, like, that's probably, even if we see marginal, you know, improvement there, that's probably enough to fix some of the things that ailed us. Because, you know, and turnovers. I think that you saw when that team was able to create turnovers, the offense was kind of rolling. It became a bit of a boulder rolling downhill for Syracuse in a great way, because you get that sort of momentum. You get a team on their heels. We had Clemson kind of on their heels for a little bit last year. We had some other teams kind of like, you know, in panic mode. When you can score that quickly, you know, a 7-point lead and quickly turn into a 20-point deficit, or as, you know, 3-point lead can suddenly turn into a 21, 28-point lead very quickly. Like, generating turnovers would make a huge, huge difference right off the bat for this defense. And, you know, we're not really going to see the hints of that part of it in particular, I hope, in the spring game, but I think we can see some of the we can see some of the building blocks being set in to see a team that can at least cover downfield better, you know, starting from the linebackers on back.
Yeah, covering better, not getting beat with those, like, huge offensive plays, and hopefully forcing some more turnovers, because that was just, like, a thing we have really struggled and would make our lives a lot easier, just because you want to get the offense the ball in with good field position. I mean, that's like the main fulcrum of how this team is supposed to be constructed. And we've kind of been playing without, like, that. I mean, we've had good field position from the punting game, but defensively, it's still been kind of an issue. So, yeah, I think just keep on taking a step forward there. And even with losing some of these, like, big-name linebackers we have, if we can improve up front in the secondary, I think it can be a wash, if not an overall improvement.
Yeah, and again, I hope we see some of that to start. There's still going to be plenty of bodies missing in this game next Friday, but I have a feeling this is going to be a shorter game than people are banking on. I know last year things kind of ended, like, a little bit abruptly, as they usually do in spring games when it seems like players start to get hit a little too hard. I'm hoping that, again, no injuries. We'll preview it probably, you know, more in earnest next week, but I'm really excited. I'm going to be watching on ACC Network Extra. I hope a lot of people from the community are there for the game. It's free. Parking's free. Kids get free autographs. You do too as an adult if you really want one. Get to pick your seat if you're a season ticket holder. A lot of cool things to do here. So, yeah, I hope we get – I mean, I don't really care about spring game attendance, but it'd be nice to at least have a good crowd out on a Friday night. A little bit of a different format for Syracuse, just to see, again, like, a lot of these young players in action.
Yeah, spring game attendance, like, I try not to get worked up about regular attendance. Spring game, definitely not. I can totally understand why someone would not want to go to the spring game. I think if you have a relatively entertaining spring game, like, you take that and run. Overall, like, there's a very good chance that, considering we haven't had, like, a true scrimmage in a long time, maybe, like, since I even started following the team, we've had, like, some close approximations, but not like a real split squad scrimmage. I totally get why people wouldn't want to go watch practice. Now, if you do, you know, you're supporting the team, and that's good. But, yeah, if we have a couple thousand people there, like, it's fine. I'm not going to get too crazy about it. There's only so many programs that have, like, great spring game attendance. Like, most of them, outside of the SEC and parts of the Big Ten, like, it's just not, like, really a thing, and that's fine.
Yeah, totally fine. We only have, like, a handful of sections open. I think they're only opening, like, 101 to 126 or something. Or 105 to 126.
Yeah. That's, like...
That's fine.
It is what it is. If you get, like, 5 or 6,000 people, you take that and run.
Yeah. Cool. So, yeah, like I said, we'll talk more about that next week. I'm sure we'll have more basketball happenings to discuss. But, Dan, pleasure as always. Appreciate you hopping on.
Yes. Hope everyone... enjoys this week of baseball and not basketball. And what do we have in lacrosse coming up? We have we've got playing really well.
Cornell coming up. I know the women's team won tonight, actually, against Loyola.
Yes, I knew that. And the men's team is kind of rolling now. Like, a tough start to the year, but they've had some really, really exciting games recently.
Defense locking it up.
Defense is locking it up. We're getting some timely goals. We've had some really clutch goals. It just seems like the team's really coming along this year, which is nice, after some fire dust snowy moments earlier in the season. Shocking that our really good coach has figured out how to bring a very young team around at midseason. It's crazy how that works.
It's crazy how that works for most Syracuse teams. The coaches we've had installed for, you know, at least 5 years or so seem to figure out how to keep their jobs year in and year out.
5 to like 25 years.
Yeah, or 42. Or 40. Anyway, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, on wherever else you listen to this, and go Orange.
Go Orange.